In this episode of The Critical Myth, the Critical Myth crew pulls the trigger with covert affairs and brings death to heaven with Doctor Who. It's episode 505. Obey your master.
That's right, we are back with episode 505 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, who is extremely surprised to discover that sitting and talking can still be enthralling.
This is Gary from Jacksonville. I'd say more, but we have so much to cover, I'm just going to stop here and we'll keep rolling.
Yes, that's right, and hopefully our friend Bronstone from Australia will be showing up shortly. But before we get started too much... There are a few changes that we're introducing as of right now. I had these in mind back for 501, but I just did not have the time to get it all together when we weren't exactly sure who was going to be available for 500, let alone 501. So since we seem to be having a little bit more time since we took the holiday week off, we are going to go ahead and introduce those changes now. And first things first, we are now going to be kind of reshaping how we cover the episodic content. That we're going to focus more directly than we already have been on the shows that we feel collectively are getting higher scores, and then a few that are getting the lower scores. And then we're only going to touch on some of the other ones. But I am still going to give everyone who is involved in the recording the chance to pick what I guess you could call a wild card, something in the middle maybe that didn't quite make the accolades and didn't descend into the depths, but still is worthy of discussion. But yeah, that should pretty much open things up for us to also delve into a few other topics along the way this week as we go through these next two episodes. So yeah, just sit back, relax, and we'll be feeling this one as we go. But first, before we go any further than that, Edmund, I think there's something that never changes, and that would be our spoiler disclaimer.
Absolutely. Whichever of these items decide to cover, we will tell you just about anything and everything we can about them. So you will, of course, naturally be spoiled. Especially as we navigate the holidays and it looks like some hiatus is coming up, well, we always try and give you plenty of time to have caught up before we do all that to you.
That's right, that's right. As we've been doing for a little while now, we're going to start off the episode with some genre news. We actually have 2 weeks' worth to go through, so a little bit of time here to jump in, but we're going to start off with what is potentially the saddest note of the evening, and Gary, if you could maybe take this first one.
Oh, absolutely. We're talking about the founder of many shows that a lot of us grew up with, especially if you're a child of the early 80s. We're talking about the passing of Glenn A. Larson. He's not only done big stuff like Magnum P.I., Battlestar Galactica stands up there, also Knight Rider, even Quincy, which was the forerunner for CSI in a lot of ways, The Fall Guy with Lee Majors, yes. And of course, the perennial of sci-fi favorite, Buck Rogers from the 25th Century with Gil Gerard. So, he's covered quite a bit of genre over the years, and, I don't know anybody who can't hear Kit's voice in their head that grew up during these years, or Tweaky, and he's responsible for all these things. And I'll even mention that he was responsible for Manimal, but I don't hold that against him. he was writing for a long time, and he did finally pass on. And some people I've heard talk that there was talk that he was working on another version of Battlestar Galactica. He was never really happy with the one that was that had come out with. That come out recently, and while he allowed it through his licensing, he was never happy with it. He felt they got too far away from the mystical. Not that I felt the first one had it, but so there was often complaints by him about the show that Ron Moore directed and ran. So I would have been curious to see what his retake on it would have been, and I don't think we'll ever get to see that at this point. So that's a little bit of a sad point, but he's left us quite a a rich legacy that we can pull up on DVD and appreciate his contribution to our collective geekdom.
Indeed. I can easily say that Larson was responsible for the lion's share of my childhood viewing, to say the least.
Definitely the same for me. And I do just want to mention that I was aware of his credits popping up on the theme songs of a lot of his shows, but I didn't realize that he was actually in a pop group called the Four Preps back in the 50s. So, certainly a very multi-talented producer.
Speaking of producers who are rather prolific these days, I think we all have heard of this guy, J.J. Abrams, I think. Now and then, it seems like his name is attached to everything.
All right, he's the guy who made Felicity.
A Wild Brunstum appears. Yes, that is correct.
If I see a Pokeball, someone's getting electrocuted.
J.J. Abrams is now teaming up with Jonathan Nolan on, I think this is the second or third project that's been announced of late. HBO confirms that Westworld will be remade and will have a 2015 air date. And you've got to love the article that starts with the line, "Are you the type of person who thinks The Leftovers is just too straightforward?" Well, let's just look down the list of people who are involved in this particular show. Anthony Hopkins, Ed Harris, Jeffrey Wright, and Rachel Wood, on and on and on. So, yeah, this could be interesting.
Now, has there been any have they given a teaser for the format of it? I mean, honestly, this was a cult favorite show back in the, early 80s, maybe it was? Late 70s, when the original Westworld came out?
Oh, the original Westworld, more like early to mid-70s. It was like 74, okay. I think. Yeah,
and it was often played as sort of a mock, to some extent, on Disney World and, some other things, too. And I have to imagine, with this kind of talent, it's going to be a much more serious approach this time around.
All it says is Westworld is a dark odyssey about the dawn of artificial consciousness and the future of sin. Format, 1 hour drama. And just what I see in this one little article is enough to make me think that Jonathan Nolan is probably the perfect person to get involved with this after his time on Person of Interest. It's like Person of Interest, the spinoff.
The mobile version.
Yeah. Also, James Marsden, Thandie Newton, Miranda Otto, Rodrigo Santoro, so on and so forth. So lots of names attached to this. So it looks like there's a lot of push for this one.
I wonder if Ed Harris will be the bald guy. Sorry.
Possibly. Bronstom, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, I was wondering if you would not mind taking the next couple. Start with the first one, of course. If you're...
with the first one, that would be... these would be the X-Men news and announcements that have been coming out. Excellent. Well, the first thing is that X-Men Apocalypse has been eyeing some A-listers for its young Jean Grey, and some newcomers for its young Cyclops. Among the names being tossed around for Jean Grey, you've got Chloe Grace Moretz of Kick-Ass and the recent Carrie remake. Also, Elle Fanning and Hailee Steinfeld, the latter being an Oscar nominee for True Grit. And meanwhile, people up for Cyclops are a bunch of people who I've never heard of. They're apparently being tossed around as like having small roles in TV shows, one of which appears to be English. But the names are people like Ben Hardy, Charlie Rowe, and Timothy Chalamet, something. I suppose it goes to show a bit about which role they consider maybe a little bit more important in the film as it's coming up. The other X-Men Apocalypse news is that they've apparently cast the titular villain. Oscar Isaac, I'm trying to read through the article as I go because I'm not quite on the ball today. It's a different actor to who was in the little stinger at the end of X-Men Days of Future Past. They say he's going to be very similar to the comic book counterpart. He's going to be a mutant who's thousands of years old. Apparently people are somewhat positive about this announcement. And I'm rolling through the article and I'm trying to find the bits where it talks about what he's been in previously. And except now the website's trying to ask me to subscribe for an email. Don't you know what? I'm doing a podcast here. Quiet, website.
Well,
Apocalypse.
Apocalypse, as a villain has appeared multiple times in the X-Men. So I'm still don't have a sense of which storyline or even storylines that they're going to grab for this. But, it's interesting because in some ways they never really beat him. He just sort of went away for most of the storylines, sort of like this, omnipotent villain who, you know, you might foul his plan up, but you never actually, you know, destroy him or conquer him or anything like that. So I'm curious, you know, how they're going to go about this. And the having the new people in it, I mean, I guess the old people were either getting too old or too expensive perhaps to really cast anymore. And you know, Days of Future Past was a nice send-off for the older members of our mutant community from this movie. But maybe I'm getting old, but you know, I'm hoping they don't cast these people too young. You know, by the time of Apocalypse, typically they have some experience. There's not like that sort of young person self-doubt and stuff like that that could be present in an earlier sense of these people. They're pretty much at the top of their game when they take on Apocalypse, so I'm hoping they, you know, extrude that confidence out when they cast people.
Well, Apocalypse is supposed to be set in the 80s, from what I've read. Like the with the past cast, they're planning on sort of moving decade through decade, so it's going to be like what, at least 15, maybe 20 years since the original team came together in First Class. So they'd have to cast sort of Jean Grey and Cyclops young in order to make it fit with the film timeline. But I can imagine everyone else that they're bringing up from the previous movies is this is going to be mutants in full control of their powers, like teams that know how to work well together. I'm not very familiar with Apocalypse from the comics, but he sounds like one of the primo high-powered X-Men bad guys. So yeah, you set up a team that's at the top of their game. And then you throw them at a villain who is powerful enough to take on a team that's at the top of their game.
Yeah, in some ways he's almost like a Doctor Doom, where he'll have a plan and then for some reason it'll fall apart and then he'll step back. But you never actually see the guy in handcuffs or anything along those lines, or in some sort of cell somewhere. That just doesn't happen. So,
yeah, I think that what this is probably alluding to is the idea that, number one, they've said that the film is going to focus quite a lot on Magneto and Mystique in the 80s, which is the, hey, we don't think we're going to get Fassbender and Lawrence after this contract is up, so we got to get as much as we can out of them. Meanwhile, it makes a certain amount of sense that there has to be a point at which the first class people and anyone associated with those time periods kind of give way to the X-Men that people know, so from the first few films. And of course it's going to be done completely differently than the way that it was done in the comics because of how they've kind of screwed up the continuity in that regard. So I don't know. I see it as a passing of the torch movie with who knows if they're going to take this cast of the young folks playing the more well-known characters in Apocalypse and then have a film or two with them to kind of link back up. I mean, there are the 90s, so of course we are going to have the inevitable grunge movie with either Generation X, or that's when they'll bring the Morlocks in. But regardless, I think they're trying to just figure out a way to have a quote-unquote clean slate. And doing this, having someone like Apocalypse might be the right way to do that. We'll see. But anyway, Edmund, why don't you take the next one, as it is pertinent to your interests.
Absolutely. WGN America has announced that Salem will return for its second series in April. They're not giving us an exact date, but they did release a photo of Mary Sibley apparently sitting pretty on a very dark and mysterious woodland throne. So the aftermaths of the Dark Rite, or Grand Rite, rather, which basically allowed the show to do this complete reset, and we really have no idea what Salem is going to be like, and what the whole witch wars and conflict is going to be. But from what they're teasing us with so far, I am looking forward to seeing where they go, or at least looking forward to it a lot more than what happened Once Upon a Time. Once Upon a Time.
There you go. That's true. All I know is that putting the promotional stuff firmly in Mary's hands is perfect because, yeah, she draws a lot of people.
Yes.
Anyway, final thing here for those of you out there who are, like me, Attack on Titan fans. This one was of interest. I thought that the whole idea of a live-action movie from Japan was just, never going to happen. And then, well, they've now released the character posters for the film currently in production. There's a whole bunch of these pictures here, but at least seven of the characters are turning out to be new to the film adaptation. though some of them, by description, seem to be just variations on characters that perhaps already exist in the original manga and the anime series. And it's supposed to be a two-film project, and the creator of the manga is, in fact, working closely with the filmmakers. So this may be a not unlike a Walking Dead type of situation, where it is the creator's chance to maybe revisit some of the ideas from the first couple adaptations, the original and then the anime. But we'll see. I'm interested in how they are going to pull this off. There's already a few people that say this could turn out to be the most expensive Japanese live-action adaptation yet. And this, of course, being the on the heels of some other anime adaptations into live-action, perhaps the one that people of our age might know best is the one that they did for Battleship Yamato not so long ago, which was actually fairly impressive. But that's it for this episode's news. We're going to then go ahead into our break, and when we come back, we're going to jump into our episodic discussion. And like I said, it's going to be a little different this time. right, and we are back with our episodic discussion, and we are going to be focusing on the shows that it has been a little while for some of these shows. I mean, some of them, it's been a few weeks. It's been at least 2 weeks for a lot of the ones that we had been up to date on. But we are going to be focusing our discussion on, right now, the shows that were at the top of our list, so to speak. And the first one that is on our list, Gary is going to be very happy to hear, Covert Affairs. Came in towards the top of our range, and we have three episodes here, so we're going to go ahead and start with. Now, I know that Gary, you only saw two of these.
Yeah, sir. Yeah. I was saving the third for this weekend. So.
Okay. Well, we'll only go over the first two then. Okay. Here then is the promo for the first episode.
I want to take down the guy who was behind the Chicago attack.
This fall,
the CIA is certainly not going to pursue him.
Annie will handle things her way.
I don't work for Langley anymore.
So I guess your life is in my hands now.
But she won't be alone.
Come on.
We'll be back together.
So what now, Neshama?
He wants to play a game of cat and mouse. Fine, I'll play.
Which one are you in that scenario?
Covert Affairs. New episodes return this fall on USA.
All right, and Gary, why don't you go ahead and do the recap here?
Absolutely, right. We're talking about Covert Affairs. Season 5, Episode 11, Trigger Cut. Annie heads towards Istanbul, where she hopes to apprehend the criminal Belenko.
Mm-hmm. And this episode came in on our scoring at an average of 8.0, so above average. No real need to go through the various ratings. They were all fairly close together. But Gary, why don't you go ahead and get us started? This was the mid-season premiere, if I recall correctly.
Yes, it is, even though it's episode 11, these lovely breaks that we're starting to get between, you know, many different networks with some of their shows. But yes, this we'll call this the winter premiere. And we got something out of the way early this season, mainly the appearance by Eyal. and he often generates high ratings. So, you know, I think that partially accounts for some of our numbers and it not being so much of a surprise. You know, there was a lot of stuff here. In some ways, it did pick right off up where the previous mid-season had ended. McQuaid was still in the hospital unconscious. Annie still was not with the CIA anymore, and something's going on with Augie, but we don't quite know what yet. And so Annie went over to Istanbul instead of sitting around in the hospital to find out what had ever happened with Belenko and what he's involved in. And as she got over there, I don't want to say met because ran into might be more of a the what I felt it was. And again, they have great chemistry with each other, and I don't mean it necessarily in a romantic way, but you know, they work well together on screen, and you know, it pulled off well as she's hunting down this guy. At some point she's got to, you know, go out on her own, and she was competent to do that. You know, some little altercations and mix-ups happened along the way, but generally, you know, it worked out almost right in the end, although the villain didn't quite get resolved in this episode. You know, progress was made towards uncovering, you know, his sort of network and plot a little bit. So overall, I enjoyed the episode. Eyal's always fun in this series to see, and he definitely didn't let down either. I sort of enjoyed not having McQuaid in there. There were some tiny bits with Arthur and things like that, and I get the feeling they're setting him up for things as well down the road. So I'm looking forward to this mini season.
Edmund, what would you add to that?
I'll certainly agree with the it's always nice having Eyal back, and just continuing that shift from possible romance to them just being two seasoned operatives who respect each other. While I was comfortable with the way they were taking the McQuaid storyline, I think having him out of the way for now did help sort of get us back into the story and get the focus back on Belenko. And of course, I'm such a huge Sean Doyle fan that anytime you want to get the focus back on him, I'm fine. I'm fine with that. And, what was going on back home? It's kind of interesting after all of this time of them playing the will they or won't they with Annie and Augie having them this separated and also just literally out of contact with Augie not really being involved with the operation and as aware of what's going on and setting him up with his other plot line of the friend who is concerned about is getting very very kind of freaked out about about what's going on, and then that whole ending with him supposedly drinking himself to death when he had been sober for so long, and Augie not accepting that. So I thought they were doing a good job of bringing us back into the story after the break, and certainly advancing the Malenko plot, but then also throwing in this stuff interesting stuff for Augie to do now that they are moving away from them as a couple at least for now until wherever things go with McQuaid as the season progresses.
Yeah, I there is a part of me that's slightly cynical about the fact that McQuaid was out of the action in this episode quite a bit. Part of me feels like maybe they wanted him to not be competition for Eyal in terms of the screen chemistry. But that being the case, you've got to do what you got to do. I do like the fact, like Gary, you were saying, that Eyal has kind of evolved over the course of the series, and now Annie is allowed to be a partner with him rather than kind of the acolyte.
Sidekick.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. So it is nice, and probably the right way to start off this second leg of the season. It also is nice to kind of be reminded of some of the quirks now that Annie is once again on the outs with the CIA, so it's not always obvious that's the case. So, anyway, let's go ahead then and move on to the next episode, and here's the promo.
Three of my guys dead in 3 months.
Augie, you could be next. You need to be protected.
Go down now, the bad guy's ass over
mom. There is an FSB assassin in the mix. The last thing I want is to lose another friend.
We have a bit of a situation. It's about Augie.
Covert Affairs, all new Thursday at 10 on USA.
All right, and Gary, if you will, please.
Absolutely. We're talking about Covert Affairs still. We're in Season 5. This is Episode 12, Starlings of the Slipstream. Annie searches for a rogue chemist in Germany after Augie uncovers a startling link between the recent attacks on American soil. Elsewhere, Jones Times in the Balkans rouses suspicions after an unplanned polygraph.
Yes, and this one was a bit of an uptick for this particular part of the season, and very close to one of the maybe a top three episode of the season so far at an 8.5. Gary, you certainly seem to like it quite a bit. You gave it a 9.
Yeah, while the last episode almost seemed, I don't want to say introductory, but it didn't seem like it was really going so much, or at least the ongoing storylines we had were pretty much put on pause for that episode. So, this episode we start to, get back into the swing of things. We got, McQuaid is, is back conscious again and everything like that. So there's that issue to deal with. And, we have this whole issue that Jones getting polygraphed for, at the time we don't know what. Later we are given a reason, and I'm still not quite sure about that reason, but we'll have to see on that, because I didn't think there was much more Joan could go in the line of promotion except to take Calder's job or become head of the CIA, and with the recent past, I doubt she'd become the head, so I'm sort of curious about that. But anyway, we finally get to see more of the structure of what's been going on with Augie and all his friends. It hasn't been just sheer coincidence or bad luck or just an isolated incident. Someone's actually going after his whole, old unit, so that's sort of interesting, and I hadn't quite pieced that part of it together. I just assumed originally it was sloppy writing in that, let's introduce a friend to Augie, now let's, get rid of him. I didn't put it together as a sort of larger scheme or plan, so the writers took me by surprise on that one, and anytime a writer takes me by surprise, I'm happy with that. And overall, I just felt like the show was moving again. It was going forward. So that's why I gave it a bit of a higher grade as well.
Edmund, how about you? You were still at about an 8, so for you it wasn't really an uptick so much as just status quo.
I was tempted to give it a bit of an uptick, I think this is one of those cases where when we have a bit of a break like this, if I was closer to the episode, I might have. Now that we're talking about it, and some of the bits and pieces of it are coming back into my head, but one thing I did like in particular particular was obviously we have the whole situation with Augie having to be bailed out, and now that McQuaid is actually out of the hospital and back in action, at least as much as he can, since Caitlin mess with his operations, understandably. I did like that similar to the way the relationship with Ayal has evolved and become more mature, that the Augie and McQuaid interactions I thought as well were rather well written and felt very authentic in terms of these two guys, both of whom care for her a lot, but aren't going to let any potential friction between the two of them get in the way of what needs to be done. So I thought that was a sign of how much the writing team has developed over these seasons. And also, I mean, and also certainly, I mean, the way they're escalating things with Augie, I mean, especially even though he's blind, we've come to expect sort of just how incredibly competent he is in all things. So I know I'm kind of jumping to the end, but it really was a bit of a shock to see him taken at the end, because it's almost reached the point where you know, he's not quite Daredevil, but he does almost see Matt Murdock-y in the way he can navigate things despite his blindness. So that was a certainly a bit of a gut punch at the end to see him taken down and cliffhang us on what's going to happen to Augie now.
Yeah, that was actually one of the, if not the reasons why I felt that this was a stronger one, was that, as Gary, you were saying, this suddenly all this stuff with Augie, I think it was you, Evan, just said it, like these little things in the background that you figure were just there, one and done, not going to come back at all and factor into anything, all of a sudden becomes important. And I don't think we've ever seen Augie in this level of personal jeopardy before. So it's kind of nice to see that happen. It was probably overdue. Especially now that he is not really the one who is romantically tied to Annie. And so we're on the other side of that now. So to see him in a position where he might need to decide where his loyalties lie is going to speak a lot to his character. Okay, so I think we have talked quite a bit about Covert Affairs. Anything that you want to add, Gary?
No, I think this has been the strongest mid-season start we've had in a while, so I'm hoping they don't botch it. But knock on wood, it's been going well. I always enjoy when Annie's played as a competent operative, and I think they're on the ball with that this year, and I hope she doesn't, devolve, as sometimes they'll do in an episode. But no, keep on keeping on. I can't wait to get the backstory of those 3 or 4 months, though. So.
Well, I can say for right now, at least, with a few episodes left this season, this is the highest scored season of the show.
I have always had faith in this show.
There you go. All right, well, I don't want Bronstone to be out of the loop too long, so I'm going to go ahead and switch gears to our next show that's towards the top of our list, and that would be, well, this is no surprise to anyone who knows us, Doctor Who. And let's go ahead then and run the promo.
I speak to you from the final days of Gallifrey. I am the past you have forgotten. You are the future I will not be able to see.
All right, and Ron Snow, if you could do the recap, please.
No worries. Doctor Who, Series 8, Episode 12, Death in Heaven. Season 8 ends with the Doctor taking on a new role as Cybermen invade the streets of London and old friends unite against old enemies. Meanwhile, questions remain as to whether unit can contain Missy.
Yes, and this episode came in with an average of 9.3. Easily the highest scored episode of the season, and the best score for Doctor Who since Day of the Doctor. So, definitely up in some rarefied air, so to speak. But, Bronstam, you in fact gave this one a perfect 10.
Yeah, I struggle to think of something about this episode that I would change or fix or meddle with to make things better. I thought it just did it was fun. It was exciting. It did a lot of interesting things with the characters, with the world of Doctor Who. And above all, it really showed just how much the 12th Doctor and Clara have developed since the beginning of the series. And it ended on, you know, not counting the stinger at the end there, but it ended on just such a sad, tragic note. Like it reminded me like a little bit of like the way that so many of the David Tennant series ended, of just trying to, you know, end on that, you know, that sad moment, like the almost the breakup. But God, those finales just feel like, they just feel like such tryhards compared to what this one did.
Yeah. Gary, how about you? I mean, it's been a few weeks, I know, but how do you feel about this finale?
Yeah, I had a lot of mixed feelings about it. First off, you know, I realize that in the larger scheme of things, I'm a newer fan to Doctor Who, coming in pretty much, you know, early Tennant. But it just seemed there was so much fan service in this episode, I was almost choking on it. For me, it was a little too much, and while I appreciate the Lieutenant and his daughter and everyone else, it seemed so thick and heavy, like they were almost like they could have been closing down a season or doing a, you know, 60th anniversary show with the way it was being thrown around, as far as I was concerned. But you know, that aside, you can't help but, you know, feel for Danny, and I have to give credit to the actor for really bringing out those emotions in me over, you know, feeling his plight and his hopelessness and it just wanting to end. And, you know, really much more, this was his story. Again, for me, this was a story where I felt the Doctor was very minimized. It was so much more, a Clara and Danny story. I can only chuckle as she keeps, you know, saying she's the Doctor, almost as if she's aware as well that she's taken over this episode. So, I mean, it was good. I mean, I think they hit everything they needed to hit. I started to suspect that, you know, Missy was the master, but I kind of liked it. But the Doctor just seemed sort of clueless about the situation to some extent. You know, in the past with Doctors, with the Master, sort of like they know each other. Like they're, you know, they're old friends that have, you know, popped up again. This Doctor, I guess his memories are still rather incomplete, and I don't get that acknowledgement sense that most of the other Doctors seem to show in the presence of the Master. So there was that, but yeah, they pulled out all the bells and whistles and must have blown the heck out of a sci-fi their expense budget for special effects. So, I mean, it was fun, it was enjoyable, and it was sad, and it was a really great show, although I still again question if it was a Doctor Who show, but it was still really good.
Yeah, I guess since I mean I was the lowest of the bunch. I mean, I was feeling a little bit of the that sort of sense, that same sense Gary was mentioning, of that need to bring in these other elements. And overall, I mean, I still give it an 8.5 because I do love having the Lethbridge Stewarts come back, both daughter and the Brigadier. I did think that, yes, while it might be a little fan servicey, I thought that was a brilliant little touch to have the Brigadier make one presumably final return. At least I would certainly hope that they do use this as the his final act of heroism, but certainly the way they were resolving the Danny and Clara and using this cyber zombie motif to do that, I thought was the absolute highlight for me. It certainly had sort of echoes of Rory and the Centurion and that sort of devotion to it, but certainly not repeating that. Finding a different way of both evoking Doctor Who elements, but at the service of sort of this final go round for their relationship, and also the very very Doctor Whovian tease of, is he going to come back? And then, no, of course, he as well continues to do the heroic thing and sends back the kid and says goodbye. So I thought it was a really beautifully done wind up to their story as well as Clara's story, since you know, now they it you know, it's one thing I found intriguing this series, since there was so much talk at the beginning about, you know, oh no, Clara's going to be moving on, and the way they were sort of teasing potential replacement companions throughout the series to have it go all the way through and have her be there for the entire series rather than having the transition somewhere within it, for me, that was the part that just really grabbed me. As far as the master, the mistress, Missy, I thought Michelle Gomez was fabulously over the top in the part. There was still something about the doing all this and then trying, you know, basically sort of tempting the doctor by handing it over to him. It made a certain amount of sense, but almost it was actually reminding me of some of the old Spider-Man Doctor Octopus battles when Spidey just started getting to the point of, you know, no, I always beat you, and why do you keep coming back? And it was almost like the master had reached that point with the doctor, and I thought that was a potentially intriguing note, but that just didn't ring as true to me as some of the rest of it.
Yeah, the only thing that I could really take away from here is just personally, I felt like Danny's ability to retain some degree of his own choices and autonomy when they were starting to emphasize more and more the hive mind aspect of the Cybermen, it was a little bit of a narrative cheat. I'm not complaining overly much about it. It just felt like, of all the things in the episode, they managed to explain most of the things that seemed like they were out of place or didn't quite make sense, and they made sense of them. In particular, I loved the how well they played the master-doctor relationship here. I mean, that is like classic third doctor type material right there. And I mean, yeah, this was about as strong as it gets when that's concerned. So to kind of soft sell the whole thing with Danny being able to conquer the Cybermen imperatives with love is just a little easy, but it worked. And like I said, the at the end of the day, he did exactly what one would expect him to do given his personality. And if this is kind of the penultimate episode with Clara, it makes sense for her to make that choice now. Before, it was kind of forced, but I think they were also playing with expectation because, you know, when she was introduced, there was a certain amount of brinkmanship going on with, say, hey, we're going to, you know, bring her in later in the season, and then introducing her kind of sort of in the premiere of Series 7. So why not play games with it in Series 8? But I'm kind of glad that they went more conventional. And I think we still have a little bit of a door open going into the final episode of this really isn't quote the finale, because of course the Christmas special is actually the end of the eighth series, but this was the end of this particular major arc, so that has a lot more to do with it as far as a conclusion is concerned. But whether or not Clara's leaving is still, I think, up in the air. But there we are. I think that this was definitely the strongest episode of the season. I love the idea of where this launches everything. The Master may have been lying, but that doesn't mean that Phrase not out there somewhere. It's just not where the Doctor thought it was going to be. I love the fact that, you know, he got kind of strung along. All of that really worked for me. Any other last thoughts on Doctor Who, this episode, or just where the direction is heading? Bronson, any last thoughts?
Just that I echo your thoughts about the Master. About Missy, I thought that she was played really well. I did see a lot of echoes of the Pertwee Delgado dynamic mix in with some of the real bat-stuff craziness of some of the latter Masters. It was a really good blending of characteristics, which you know, the exact same can be said of you know, all of the new series Doctors, really, is that they've you know, even when they overemphasize one particular aspect, they really, you know, it's still consistent with what we know of the character. I thought she did a great job. I hope she comes back in some capacity. And yeah, this leaves things on a great note, and it says a lot about what Doctor Who can do in the future, both with these particular characters and with the show as a whole. Like, they can. This series was a much more dramatic and character driven than I think any we've had to date. And I don't think we could have predicted that at the when Capaldi was cast, that we were going to have such a serious and introspective season, series, I should say. And yeah, it was great. I'm looking forward to where the show goes next.
Yep. Gary, any last thoughts?
Just in general, I guess, you know, I still have not been that impressed with Capaldi as a doctor. I'm just looking for something more, some depth to the character that I still have not seen. So I'm still holding out hope, but I have to admit I've been disappointed.
Edmund?
I will say I have been rather pleased with Capaldi, and Ewan Bronstam mentioning the old Pertwee Delgado master dynamic makes me realize that I should probably go back and rewatch those.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to maybe the Clara moving on, and then the 12th Doctor getting the opportunity to work with someone from the start, not someone who's already established, but really getting a chance to sink his own teeth into his own show, so to speak. Mm. But while we still have a few minutes left of this particular show, do we have enough time to jump into another one of our topics here? I don't know that we do. Most of these are kind of lengthy. I would like then just to have a few moments with Edmund to go over Homeland.
Sure.
Not necessarily episode by episode, but I am just going to point out here that Homeland was a show that I think we all were essentially ready to drop completely. And I know that Edmund and I kind of independently came to the conclusion, we'll give it one last shot after last season's debacle. And with only three episodes left, we have season 4, episode 8, Halfway to a Donut, which got an 8.8 average between the two of us, and then season 4, episode 9, Something Else is Going On, which got a 9 average. So, so far this season is riding a full point above last season. It is well on its way towards the kind of strength that the first two seasons had. And, I'm kind of surprised by this. There was a little bit of a slump there in the middle, but it seems to have really been picking up steam again. Usually, as I think you put it, Edmund, around the time that we're used to to Homeland kind of phoning it in.
Yeah, definitely, and there did seem to be the danger of that with Carrie's creepy seduction particularly where it was happening in the middle of the season that the writers were once again going to in terms of the previous seasons, it was where we season two we wound up with our mastermind terrorist actually on American soil and doing creepy horror movie stuff in abandoned factories and then of course just the turning Brody and magically curing him of addiction and sending him off to do a special forces and covert operation in Iran last season. So I really thought they were heading down a similar path, and instead, basically the subject of the seduction, who it seemed was going to be the main focus, turned out to be just the MacGuffin who was used to catapult us into the action for the final part of the season and then be cruelly discarded. So we could actually get on to a terrorist threat that's actually feeling real and credible, and as of the last episode is closing in on the American embassy and in ways that actually felt much more realistic for a show that is an over-the-top CIA spy saga. I will say the only thing that did disappoint me was the reveal that Raza Jaffery's Pakistani general was not in on the whole thing. I was already a little surprised that the head of counterintelligence was sitting there comforting her in her hallucinogenic state, asking who's Brody. It's like, you know who Brody is if you're in this position. So that's the only way that them trying to make him that this much of a sort of good guy is something I'm a little disappointed in. But as you saw from the scores, I mean not enough to really stick in my craw the way some of the stuff they've done in previous seasons has.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. And for me, I mean the. this whole thing going on with Saul is just heart-wrenching.
Yes.
And, you know, when you talk about shows where you are just staring at the screen, kind of aghast and in horror, and then you realize you're actually watching Homeland, and a year ago you never in a million years would have expected that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I remember, I mean, back at the beginning of season three, when it seemed that they had shuffled Brody off of the screen for we hoped a good extended time, which of course didn't hold up. And our hope was that, you know, no, they'd get back to focusing on Carrie and Saul, and certainly with the whole prisoner exchange that whole fraught situation on the tarmac. You know, no, it was finally letting Mandy Patinkin and Claire Danes, you know, just have their head acting wise, and they really delivered.
Yeah, so we have three episodes left of that season. We'll see if they can keep this up or if they're going to drop the ball again. Unfortunately, this is one of those situations where, because they tend to turn on a dime, you can never quite be sure.
Yes.
We'll find out, though.
Fingers crossed.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.